Thought for Food. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This is Bob Krueger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Thought for Food for July 2011. On July 4th, we Americans celebrated the 235th anniversary of the founding of our nation. Although some of the celebrations, hot dogs and fireworks, were rained out, we knew in our hearts that this was an auspicious occasion. Someone else also had an anniversary. Cheerios are now 70 years old. And here's a little quiz for the breakfast table. What's the most popular cereal brand in American grocery stores? Hint, it's been General Mills' top brand name since 1951. Another hint, if you're a parent, you vacuumed it from the minivan and under the high chair cushion by the cupful. The answer, of course, is Cheerios. The iconic cereal, known for its distinctive yellow box, is 70 years old this year and still a force on the breakfast cereal market. One out of every 8 boxes of cereal to leave the shelf in America carries the Cheerios names. They've been around since the beginning of man, right? Said Kathy Scott in Cape Coral, Florida. For her, the cereal evokes memories of childhood Saturday morning cartoons. My mother was very old-fashioned, a stay-at-home mom, Scott, 50, said. She made breakfast every morning, but on Saturday mornings we were allowed to have cereal. Throw some fruit in there, sit on the floor, and watch cartoons. The tradition repeats itself with her own 2 children. Saturday morning cartoons and Cheerios, she said. To make Cheerios, balls of dough are heated and shot out of a puffing gun at hundreds of miles an hour, according to General Mills. The company's waterfront plant in Buffalo, New York, has been firing them off since 1941, often cloaking the city with a distinctive toasty with a sweet, fresh aroma and inspiring T-shirts announcing, "My city smells like Cheerios." More than 10 shapes and sizes were considered before the makers settled on the Little O's. Since then, the company introduced several new flavors, starting with Honey Nut in 1979 and last year, Chocolate. In 2009, sales of Honey Nut Cheerios surpassed the original flavor for the first time and remains in the top today. But Kathleen Dole, 30, sticks to the originals, the one she refers to as the old-school yellow box plain Jane variety. She buys it in bulk at Sam's Club to keep her 6- and 3-year-olds happy. That's one of the first real people foods that they ate, the Chester, Virginia mother said. They know that when we're having a morning when we're running late, they're like, can I get a snack bag of Cheerios, she said, because it's something I can't say no to. I can say no to chips. I can say no to candy. I can say no to a dozen other things. But a snack bag of Cheerios, how can you say no to that? Oh, yes, she's cleaned them out of the car seats. At least they're not sticky, she said. So that's a plus. Once you grind them in, they look just like the rest of the dirt. They don't look neon colored. Minneapolis-based General Foods began advertising Cheerios, first called Cheeriotes, as a first food for toddlers in 1974. And since 1999, the company's focused on promoting the cereal as healthy. It's made from whole grains with 3 grams of fiber and 1 gram of sugar per serving. But in 2009, federal regulators took issue with the cereal box's claim that it was clinically proven to lower cholesterol. In a warning letter, the Food and Drug Administration said that only FDA-approved drugs can make such a claim. General Mills, in its response, stood by its claims and said that FDA's complaints dealt with how the language appeared on the box, not the cereal itself. The case is still open, an FDA spokeswoman said. Since cereal is a major source of fiber for Americans, something most people shortchange themselves on, Cornell University nutrition expert David Levitsky said it's actually not a bad idea to eat cereal as a relatively low-calorie lunch or dinner once in a while, even the sugar-sweetened variety. They're seducing kids to eat it, he acknowledged. It's a technique that breakfast food companies have learned, and it works, but it's got a good aspect because that's where they're getting their fiber in the morning, he said. All these cereals are enriched. One of the problems I see with the new types of Cheerios is that each new variety tends to have more sugar than the original, and I found that private label Cheerio-type cereals are much less expensive and have as much nutritional value as the name brand. On June 2nd, the government changed its symbol for healthful eating. We no longer have the food pyramid as a guide, but now we see My Plate. The new guide is divided into four slightly different sized quadrants, with fruits and vegetables taking up half the space and grains and protein making up the other half. The vegetables and grains portions are the largest of the four. Gone is the old pyramid that guided some Americans while confusing many others. There will no longer be any references to sugars, fats, or oils. What was once a category called meat and beans is now simply protein, making way for seafood and vegetarian options such as tofu. Next to the plate is a blue circle for dairy, which could be a glass of milk or a food such as yogurt or cheese. Some critics have accused the Obama administration of overreaching on regulation, especially when it comes to new rules that tell schools what children can eat on campus. But the plate is supposed to be a suggestion, not a direction, said Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. We're not telling people what to eat. We're giving them a guide, he says. We're not suggesting they should not have a cookie or a dessert. That's not what it's about. Vilsack said the new round chart shows the nutrition doesn't have to be complicated. After almost 20 years of leaders preaching good eating through a food pyramid, the department now says was overly complex, obesity rates have skyrocketed. He showed off the new plate with First Lady Michelle Obama, who has made healthful diets for children a priority. Parents don't have time to measure out exactly 3 ounces of protein, she said as she introduced the new graphic. We do have time to look at our kids' plates. The new chart is designed to be more artistic and attractive and to serve as a visual cue for diners, said Robert Post of the Agriculture Department's Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion. He has spent 2 years developing the plate. Nutritionists cheered the death of the food pyramid, the program that the USDA used from 1992 until now. The pyramid was so confusing, says Cheryl Kuta Sutter, a registered dietitian with the Presbyterian Novant Health and Wellness in Charlotte. It wasn't easy for children to learn. It wasn't easy for adults to follow. It wasn't easy to teach. Despite the pyramid's nearly 20-year reign, the flaws were numerous, dietitians said. It wasn't visually intuitive. It was too complicated. It allowed too many daily categories. It created a state of confusion among the public. A plate, they say, is so much better. Visually, it's easier to understand, said Ashley Honeycutt, a registered dietitian with Rex Wellness Center in Raleigh. Kids can recognize the plate. It just makes more sense. Besides, Kahutna Sutter says dietitians have been using a plate as a teaching tool for years. The plate's emphasis on fruits and vegetables is a healthier message. It decreases the portion size of the higher fat, higher calorie items, said Melissa Herman with Eat Smart Nutrition Company in Huntersville, North Carolina. The plate's main messages are that fruits and vegetables should fill half of the plate. You should choose low-fat or non-varied dairy products. You should choose lean proteins such as poultry, seafood, beans, and soy products. The government recommends that adult men who exercise at least 30 minutes a day consume no more than 2,400 calories a day, while adult women should consume no more than 2,000. Dietitians offer these suggestions. Dairy is not optional, even though it's off to the side of the plate where a glass would be. Eliminate sugary drinks from your diet. Drink 100% fruit juice, low-fat or non-fat milk, or water instead. Watch your portion sizes. Plates have gotten bigger in recent years. Make sure your plate is not the size of a platter. Eggs are protein, even though we find them in the dairy counter. Limit butter and cheese sauces on your vegetables. It is healthier to bake, broil, or grill lean proteins than to fry them. Eliminate solid fats such as butter and shortening to avoid empty calories and added sugars such as those in energy drinks, sports drinks, sodas, cakes, and cookies. Suzanne Havala Hobbs, whose weekly column On the Table appeared in the News Observer on Wednesdays, had this comment about My Plate. The new graphic is far easier to understand, and the information it conveys is closer to accurate. That's because the plate puts into perspective how the American dinner plate and diet should look. Non-fat and low-fat dairy products orbit the plate as add-ons, with fortified soy beverages listed as alternatives. It's the only major fault I see in the new plan. The dairy requirements perpetuate the idea that cow's milk must be in the picture. It doesn't. We need to find a better way to address through dietary guidance the complicated issue of calcium nutrition. In general, though, my plate is a big improvement. In a rather cynical editorial that appeared in the St. Louis Dispatch newspaper the next day, he raised this point. Will the food plate change anything? Of course not. It is intended only as a part of a broader public education program, but even that won't be enough. The editorial further states, studies show people make poor food choices because they either don't care, don't want to go to the trouble of preparing better meals, or they can't afford the heavy load of fresh fruits and vegetables that nutritionists recommend. If there's a category of people that don't know the difference, it's very small. A new exhibit at the National Archives titled, What's Cooking, Uncle Sam? The Government's Effect on the American Diet reveals that our government's been involved in trying to influence we Americans to do a better job of selecting a healthful diet. More than 80 years before Got Milk, there was Eat the Carp. And this slogan was dreamed up by the U.S. Department of Fisheries in 1911 as a part of an effort to push this uncomely fish into American kitchens, one of many ways the federal government has tried over the past two centuries to direct how Americans eat through promotional campaigns, nutritional admonishments, factory regulations, and gardening tips. Many of these efforts are documented in this exhibition. Through documents, food labels, film footage, photographs, and other artifacts from the Revolutionary War to the 1980s, the show offers fascinating and at times quirky reminders of the vast and perpetual role that the federal government has played in all things edible, with goals both laudable and perverse. The ongoing debates in Congress concerning food safety, which stemmed from a slew of E. coli outbreaks, was preceded decades ago by an outrage over death due to toxic candy sold by street vendors. That helped spark the regulation of commercial food, documented through photos and papers in the exhibit. Long before the makers of fatty crackers tried to sell Americans on their nutritional value, the government was pushing enriched white bread as a fantastic source of vitamin B1. The ever-evolving food pyramid was presaged by a nutrition chart that counted butter as its own food group. Government has been involved in our food system since the early days of colonial America, said Andrew F. Smith, a food historian and author of numerous books on the subject. I think among virtually all of the foods you eat, the federal government has certainly had a role in it. The idea of a show exploring the government's place in the national food chain was hatched up by the Archives Director of Exhibits, Christina Rudy Smith, who stumbled upon a document from 1776 designed to entice men to enlist in the Continental Army through the promise of three solid meals a day. Her inkling that the archives could be harnessed to tell the story of food in the United States was bolstered by the discovery of, among other items, such as a recipe for portable soup left behind from the Lewis and Clark expedition. People have been concerned with exactly the same things from nutrition to food safety for hundreds of years, said exhibit curator Alice Camps. The exhibition is organized into four parts: farm, which explores the relationship between government and growers; factory, which looks at the history of food regulation and processing; kitchen, which includes displays and nutritional studies and government education programs concerning food; and table, which documents the way the government has fed people from schools to military bases. The show also peers into the White House kitchen with menus from state dinners, President Lyndon Johnson's barbecue apron, and a smattering of recipes like the one for Queen Elizabeth's scones and Lady Bird Johnson's chili. But like all guides of any sort, they're worthless unless we take the advice that is offered. I have no idea how well people will understand this new plate guideline. It's up to each of us to follow or ignore these guidelines. We've been told that fats and fatty foods are not good for us. But despite this bad reputation, some good fats are needed in a healthy diet. And part of our problem is that there are so many types of fat that we become confused. Perhaps we can clarify and help clear up some of our misunderstanding about fats. We should limit trans fats. Trans fat is made when hydrogen is added to vegetable oil, a process called hydrogenation. Hydrogenation increases the shelf life and the flavor of foods containing these fats. Trans fat is found in vegetable shortening, some margarine, crackers, cookies, snack foods, and other foods made with or fried in partially hydrogenated oils. The word cholesterol is familiar to all of us, but do we actually know what it is? Cholesterol is a fat-like, waxy substance created by your liver and found in the bloodstream and in all of your body's cells. It's important for your body to have some cholesterol as it's used for producing cell membranes and some hormones, but too much cholesterol is a major risk for heart disease. More healthy fats include monounsaturated fat. This is a fat that's a liquid at room temperature but will solidify when chilled. Foods with monounsaturated fats include olive oil, peanut, and canola oils, as well as avocados and most nuts. Polyunsaturated fat stays liquid regardless of temperature and is found in safflower, corn, sunflower, and soybean oils. Omega-3 fatty acids are polyunsaturated fats found mostly in cold water fish such as salmon, mackerel, herring, and sardines. Flax seeds and walnuts also contain omega-3s, and a small amount are also found in soybean and canola oils. So despite a bad reputation, good fats should be a part of our diet. Remember the word, moderation. Last month, we shared some news on research taking place in North Carolina about the healthful qualities of berries. And a recent story tells of an effort to produce a better flavored strawberry by a combination of North Carolina State University scientists and Johnson & Wales University in Charlotte, which turns out chefs. The story begins. Expert taste tester Judy Hyman plucks a ripe red strawberry from a plate, takes a bite, and pauses to let the taste register on her tongue. "I'd give it a 9 on a sweetness scale," she said. Another taste tester bites into a berry, puckers, and writes astringent on her chart. The taste testers belong to a team hired in May as part of the North Carolina Strawberry Project. Their job to tease out the subtle differences in flavor and appearance between one strawberry and another. Watching through an observation window in an adjacent room, project director and NC State researcher Jeremy Patterson plans to use their results in his efforts to breed a tastier, hardier North Carolina strawberry. He also hopes to hold strawberry taste tests with produce buyers and chefs to find out what each group looks for in an ideal berry. The project is unique in plant breeding world in that we're asking the culinary industry to help us define what makes for the tastiest fruit, he says. The ideal strawberry means different things to different people, Patterson said. A chef, for example, may want a redder, sweeter berry. A farmer may want a berry that resists attack by fungals, pathogens, and insect pests. The produce buyer may want one with longer shelf life. Patterson kneels down amid the rows and gently squeezes a berry to gauge its firmness, a good quality for packing and shipping. "We've got 8,000 one-of-a-kind strawberry plants out here, and we've got to find out what's special about each one," he says. North Carolina produces more than 19 million pounds of strawberries each year, making it fourth state in the nation in strawberry production after California, Florida, and Oregon. The three main strawberry varieties currently grown in North Carolina are originally bred for climate conditions in California and Florida, Patterson said. Strawberries may be sold in supermarkets year-round, but North Carolina-grown berries are only available from 4 to 6 weeks a year, beginning in late April in the eastern part of the state and extending through late May in the mountains. To make locally grown strawberries available for a longer period of time, the key is to breed a berry more suitable for the state's climate, Mr. Patterson says. It still may take 10 years or more before Patterson brings his first fruits to the market. We wish these folks much success in this venture. The pickle lady grows her own cucumbers in Piedmont soil. She personally delivers her jars to Harris Teeter and dozens of shops and restaurants. It's not uncommon for her to get an early start on arranging jars on grocery store shelves where customers are still asleep. Her marketing motto, never miss an opportunity to give away pickles to public officials or anyone else, can help get your brand greater visibility. That includes mailing pickle samples to state lawmakers and even send a care package to President Barack Obama. Hustling Pickles is how Jenny Fulton of Forsyth County got herself invited to Durham last month to participate in a roundtable discussion with the President's Council of Jobs and Competitiveness. Fulton sat in a DuPont corporate conference room, playing up the pickle humor in a room full of venture capitalists and startup executives, and cheerfully talking up the potential of globally exporting her grandmother's pickling recipe. "We want to be a household name and a generational company like Smucker's, a generational company," Fulton told the assembled business leaders. After her pickles conquered North Carolina, which is hardly the moonshot it seemed just a year ago, she's setting her sights on an ambitious target: U.S. and international palates hungering for Carolina country cukes bathed in brine. "Life has changed beyond recognition for Fulton, 41, since the Kernerville pickle entrepreneur was laid off her stockbroker job just a year and a half ago. Her business partner, Ashley Furr, 39, was Fulton's assistant at Morgan Keegan and was also pink-slipped in June of 2009. Today, her homespun brand, Miss Jenny's Pickles, is carried in more than 100 stores, mostly on the East Coast. She's gotten into Harris Teeter and Whole Foods, as well as gourmet chain Dean and DeLuca, which charges $9 for a 24-ounce jar of Miss Jenny's habanero bread and butter and jalapeno salt and pepper slices. In the Triangle, Miss Jenny's pickles are carried at the Angus Barn, a Southern Season, Foster's Market, NOFO, and Whole Foods. Her brand soon could be found in more than 500 stores, Fulton estimates. That would be a major breakthrough, requiring contracts with cucumber farmers and shipping operators on an industrial scale. It would also mean that by early next year, Fulton and Furr would finally draw their first paychecks. Since starting the company 22 months ago, the pair have been working 15-hour days and logging 1,000 miles a week for deliveries and site visits without paying themselves. National distribution would force Fulton to rethink the practicality of listing her personal phone number on every jar of pickles that bears her name. "I don't know the rhyme or reason for her demand," said Alan Younger, a business counselor at the NC Small Business Development Center in Winston-Salem, who advised Fulton. "I wish I could put it in a jar and sell it. There are a lot of people out there who would love to have her mojo." Graduating to the next level would require a departure from the gourmet formula that has defined Miss Jenny's Pickles and creating a line of mass-produced pickles, very likely spears instead of slices. On the verge of taking the leap, Fulton looks back and wonders at a 2-year pickling adventure. Who really gets to accomplish what we have in this short of time? A story like this is inspiring, and we add our congratulations to all who work so hard to get this new company established. We can only hope that their small neighborhood atmosphere will not get lost as they start rapid expansion. Public enemy number one in America's Battle of the Bulge isn't a cupcake, a soda, or a double bacon cheeseburger. It's the simple potato, according to Harvard University researchers. Daily consumption of an extra serving of spuds, French fried, sliced into crispy chips, mashed with butter and garlic, or simply boiled or baked, was found to cause more weight gain than downing a 12-ounce can of sugary drink or taking an extra helping of red or processed meats. Altogether, after tracking the good and bad diet and lifetime choices of more than 120,000 health professionals from around the country for at least 12 years, the research team calculated that participants gained an average of 0.8 pounds a year, close to the U.S. average, according to a report in the June 23rd issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. It may not sound like much, but years go by, it becomes compounding interest, adding up to 16 pounds over 20 years, said Dr. Jeffrey Schwimmer, the director of the Weight and Wellness Program at the Rady Children's Hospital in San Diego, California, who wasn't involved in the study. Potatoes were once hailed as the nation's most important vegetable, and the Incas, whose ancestors are credited with domesticating spuds in South America, worshipped a potato god. Potatoes were certified as heart-healthy food by the American Heart Association. Just 3 years ago, the United Nations declared 2008 the International Year of the Potato, praising the tuber for being a good source of vitamin C, several B vitamins and minerals, including iron, potassium, phosphorus, and magnesium. But when the team from the Harvard Medical School and the Harvard School of Public Health in Boston examined the role of potato in the modern diet, they found that people who ate an extra serving of French fries every day gained an average of 3.4 pounds over a four-year period. On top of that, those who munched an extra serving of potato chips daily gained an average of 1.7 pounds every 4 years. Overall, an extra serving of potatoes prepared in any non-chipped form was found to contribute an average 1.3 pounds to total weight over 4 years. The typical American consumes 117 pound potatoes each year, including 41 pounds in the form of frozen French fries, according to data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The problem, said study co-author Dr. Walter Willett, chairman of the nutrition party at the Harvard School of Public Health, is that we don't eat potatoes raw, so it's easier for the body to transform the starch to glucose. Potatoes were a great part of my diet in my growing up years. My dad was a great gardener, and we often had a half-acre plot for just potatoes. I think my mom could prepare potatoes in more ways than anyone I know. I still like potatoes, although I do not eat French fries. I know that I don't need the grease in my diet. And over half of those I observe eating French fries have no idea what the potato tastes like. All they taste is the ketchup they smear on them. My favorite way eat a potato is baked. The danger with a baked potato is the amount of butter, sour cream, and other goodies we trim them with. Norma Lyon achieved fame well beyond the Midwest as the butter cow lady at the Iowa State Fair. She sculpted famous people and once the diorama of the Last Supper. Lyon, a dairy farmer's wife, died recently in Marshalltown, Iowa. She was 81, and she sculpted tons of butter into these life-size figures. Her sculptures reached a vast audience, partly because she worked not in Iowa, but at state fairs throughout rural America, and partly because the idea of a butter sculpture from rural Iowa was irresistible to the television in the big city. She appeared on the Today and Tonight Show, and on the date night with David Letterman in 84, she showed up with a cheddar cheese version of her butter cow to make it easier to carry, she said. Asked how she felt about her novelty appearance on TV, her daughter Michelle said she loved it. You betcha. My mom was a person who loved for people to know her work, and by the way, she knew it was good for the dairy industry. From 1960 until retirement in 2006, Lyon's butter sculpture were among the must-sees at the Iowa State Fair. Until next month, this has been Bob Kruger with Thought for Food, and the content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. And so long until next time.